Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to another delightful episode of Comedy Film Nerds.
Wow, you got the giggles this morning.
I don't know what happened.
It's weird. And we're pre-recorded.
We are. So, we always are pre-recorded,
yes.
Chris.
Well,
every
by an hour. But now it's actually, you're in another country right now.
Yes, if you're listening to this, I am in Kuwait. So... Or I'm, that sounds like I'm dead. If you hear this,
if you hear this sound,
I'm dead. So
tell my family.
Tell my family. Take my Batman comics and give them to my nephews. And wait till they're 20.
Yeah.
They're too young right now. So yes, I am in Kuwait this week. This is a banked theme episode.
Very excited too, because we're going to be talking about low budget filmmaking.
Yeah, we have an excellent filmmaker as a guest. This is going to be a cool show. We don't often have as many. We have more comics obviously on than filmmakers.
Sure.
So it's great when we get a filmmaker around here to get into the nuts and bolts of it. I guess first I will say. Thank you to everybody that came out to see me in San Diego with Doug. So we're pre-recording that before that show actually happened. So I'm assuming it was a great show. And thanks for everybody to coming out. So God only knows that show will have like blown up and Doug loses his shit. And
yeah. And then now a week from now, I can't believe Graham thanked everybody from that show.
He threw shit at everybody from stage. Why would he thank people? So in the event that you were at that show, I hope it went great. I hope it was awesome.
And if so, thank you.
Thank you. If it was horrible, I'm sorry. I'll blame Doug.
And Podcast Festival coming up very, very quickly.
Yes. LAPodFest.com. You know, it's been really cool. I was on the Todd Glass show, and you and I have been on several other shows talking about it. And it's been so awesome because, like, to hear the podcasters, Todd's already, like, very excited because he's like, I want people to, like, my show's early in the morning, come down from the rooms in their pajamas and make it into a big crazy thing. So it's really, it's fun because everyone's starting to get really excited about it and making it like a whole, people are pumped about, like, I'm saving my money. I'm coming in from out of town.
Really were making it more of like a film festival feel to it. Everyone's in the same place, walk around, socialize, go to events, panels. But think of it as a film festival that you see podcasts and you're going to be laughing for three straight days.
Yeah, and it's also, too, the thing I want to say is it's very much like so many of the fans of like of this show, you guys talk to each other online. I would love for all of us to meet. Like a lot of you I've never met. I'd love to meet you, you know, and some of you fans have become friends online and stuff like that. So we really want to create that environment. And since most of you listen to more than one podcast, we just want it to be a big party, a big fun celebration
really
fun. Of podcasting.
And then one giant stand-up show.
Mega shark stand-up show. I wonder why I chose that. LAPodFest.com. The hotel rooms are going quick. There's festival passes and tickets. Like, if all you can do is...
It's a giant octopus of a festival.
It really is. It's kind of like some guy who kills people.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is all going to make sense, you guys. Yeah. I know I'm in Kuwait. I'm freaking out.
Yeah, in about 3 minutes.
I'm time traveling. LAPodFest.com, guys. And let's introduce our guest.
Very, very excited to have him. Introduced to him through our comedy film nerd writer, Alan Havey. And we've seen his work. And I have to say, I really enjoyed his last film, Some Guy Who Kills People. Ladies and gentlemen, filmmaker Jack Perez.
Hello. Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Honored.
So first of all, let's talk about how did you meet Alan Havey?
I met Alan Havey.
And do you regret it?
No. I've known Alan many, many, many years. I was a fan of his show Night After Night.
It was a great show.
Such a great show.
Yeah, it was a great. We were just, you know, I was looking at some clips on YouTube recently, and I hadn't seen it in years, and it's such a
weird thing. It was like ahead of its time. It was like when there were like two comedy channels, they didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah,
and then I'm like, oh well, at least they got that right. That's what you would watch a show. I'm like, oh well, why isn't there more programming like that?
I remember being a young comic and watching that show and Alan King's show.
Right.
Were amazing because you got to see comics talk seriously about stand up. Comedy. That was the thing that I found so impressive.
Yeah.
You know, it was such a cool discussion and a great sort of education for me as a young comic to go, wow. Like to hear, I remember watching, you know, Havey interview, God, was it like Ellen DeGeneres when she was just breaking on the scene and she was like doing her riffing. It was very funny. But then he also like got her to talk. I mean, obviously she hadn't come out then or anything like right. that, but just go into what her comedy was and where it was coming from. It was really interesting, you know?
Yeah, he always had great interviews. You know, I remember one he did with Robert Downey Sr. That was really
interesting. You've known Alan for a long time.
Well, the thing is that I was a fan of the show and my girlfriend mm-hmm. was obsessed. And wrote in, and at the time, if you wrote in, you could be part of his audience of one, where he had this little roped off area where one, because it was shot, there was no live audience, it was just one person, one fan. And but I still didn't know him until after I did a film called La Cucaracha, and a friend of his, Victor Rivers, was in that movie, and at a screening at Raleigh, Victor brought Alan as a guest, and he said, "Hey, here's my friend Alan." I said, "Oh, I've been watching your show for years," and his girlfriend at the time and my wife at the time, when it's still my wife, all hit it off, and so we've all been friends pretty much ever since. Cool. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah, the reason we bring that up is Alan put this whole together. He emailed us and was like, "You guys got to have Jack Perez on the show and talk about films and all that." Because right. Alan has been such a like a unique voice for this site and show and everything because he's older and like his chapter in the book is
about war movies is war amazing. Movies.
Right. It's amazing because right. it's about movies that, you know, many of us haven't seen or he was watching them as a kid in the theater, you know, and talking to his dad and relatives who were in those wars and right. stuff like that, which is really fascinating.
It's something that we definitely share. I mean, when he told me he was doing the book for you guys, the chapter for you guys, you know, it was great because, you know, we both are hardcore war movie geeks and my father is a military historian. So I was introduced to all those movies, you know, all the propaganda films from the early 40s and everything. And I'm just always been a big fan of the genre. So, you know, we went back and forth while he was writing that chapter.
Now, how did the war propaganda movies influence your directive, Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus?
Clearly, you know, John Wayne's Green Berets.
Right, exactly. Peterson. And probably not at all, except there's a couple of army guys in fighting the mega shark. Yeah, you know, it's funny because, you know, as I got older, my father was such a war movie fanatic, and I always felt, you know, that one day I would make a war movie that, you know, he would be proud of or something. But as I got older, I realized that the filmmakers that really make the best, the filmmakers that should make war films are the ones that have experienced war, and there are only a handful of those filmmakers. Sam Fuller, who did, you know, Merrill's Marauders and Steel Helmet and The Big Red One, mm-hmm. is one of them, you know, who was obviously combat infantry in the Second World War. Oliver Stone, you know, people like, and William Wellman, you know, who made Battleground. Those guys all knew what war was, and in a way, you almost have a right to say something about it. And even like something like Saving Private Ryan, which vets will say, yes, you know, the combat experience is very, very real. It's close. And I've spoken to vets who say, yes, that mm-hmm. sort of carnage is what it is. But in a way, I almost feel like in order to do a war film, you have to have a real point of view about it from having been there. Otherwise, even Saving Private Ryan, for as gory as it is, it still comes off very sort of, you know, rah-rah. Like, you know,
it's a Hollywood
movie, yeah. You know what I mean? And so the propaganda films of the 40s, you know, where you see Japanese bayoneting wounded and, you know, they're definitely monsters, Coke bottle glasses and drooling, you know, as they bomb hospitals. That stuff you could understand in the period because they were making that to boost enlistment. But if you make that now, you're just sort of a jingoistic racist.
Let me ask you in terms of now, like Letters from Iwo Jima.
Right, right, right.
What do you think about that in, you know, in terms of Clint Eastwood's eye to those films from today's point of view?
Right, right. Well, it's funny because I just watched the Eastwood thing. Have you guys seen the thing?
Oh, yeah.
That's talking to the empty chair.
Let's put that aside for now.
Clint. Sorry. I never Twitter. I haven't gotten into it, but I finally tweeted today. I said, you know, Mel Gibson ruined The Road Warrior. Now I can't watch Where Eagles Dare ever again. You know, that kind of thing. Because it's just like one of those things where just, I don't even want to know. You're just ruining you're just right. back ruining everything. I think, you know, there's definitely stuff in, I mean, you can make it earnest. I don't think Letters from Iwo Jima or Flags of Our Fathers come across necessarily as a rah-rah gung-ho picture. They're fairly bleak. Sort of.
Now it's interesting.
Combat, you know. So, yeah.
This is a great point because I saw those movies and I saw them as just well-crafted movies showing different sides mm-hmm. of a war. And People bring with them, we always say this, all sorts of their beliefs and baggage, and they see things in there that weren't necessarily intended. Like, you know, you could see it was like, oh, this is like liberal propaganda and all, you know, for Letters from Iwo Jima. I'm like, no, it's a conservative made this movie, right. And it's just a movie, you know, and he got nailed. On a couple of things. He got mailed a $1 million baby for, you know, promoting euthanasia and things right. like that. And right. it's so weird because you know that was not his intention. He's just making a movie with a compelling story and compelling characters. Right. But people bring all sorts of their perceptions with
them. They bring empty chairs. Yeah. Sort
of. Well, I thought that maybe I could get away with doing like maybe a period war picture. Like, you know, when I saw – or a story that hasn't been – like when Glory came out, you know, mm-hmm. that was a story that most people didn't mm-hmm. know about the 54th. That,
right.
You know, there was a black regiment and what they did. So that was in a way almost like, okay, I'm going to bring this information forward. But if you hear someone like Sam Fuller talk about actual combat mm-hmm. and how, you know, and he talked, and Sam Fuller has this like, you know, and he's like, yeah, you know, after a battle, he goes, there's a man's thigh over there and there's another man's head and there's a man's cock and you put it all in a box and they that's what they ship home. There's your papa. He says, like, that's, and you're like, okay, well, that, you know, even as gory as Saving Private Ryan is, you don't get that stuff.
No,
so,
no.
In a way, the most responsible presentation of combat would be something like completely unwatchable. You know, you get into that kind of conversation about movies about the Holocaust, too. It's like, you know, how can you really represent, like, you know, not that, you know, we're getting into, sorry, Auschwitz is probably not for the comedy yeah. show. Let's move on from that. But anyway, sorry, digress. War's not funny.
No, it doesn't have to be funny. No, this is a good discussion to have because it is like one of the things, getting back to Letters of Iwo Jima real quick. One of the things that I found compelling about that film is having watched many of the, even as a kid in the 70s, I watched movies that had come out 10, 15 years, 20 years earlier. And the depiction of the Japanese is always, as you say, the Coke bottle-eyed monsters mm-hmm. and all this stuff like that. And Letters from Iwo Jima, it was like...
Especially when you get into the like the comedy aspects of it. Everything from the Warner
really
Brothers cartoons
stuff.
To... Three Stooges episodes.
Oh, my yeah. God. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah.
You want to die. You know, they ran that at the Castro a few years ago and in San Francisco. And, you know, it's like that stuff comes on and you just want to... Actually, there's a great scene in the movie Dragon. Did you ever see Dragon?
Oh, yeah.
The Bruce Lee story where he's in the movie theater. And
everyone's laughing.
And he's just got this look of just, you know, he's just stricken. Yeah. And it is a very powerful scene because most people, you know, definitely at the time were like, that's fine. You know, it's perfectly fine. You know,
and it's Andy Rooney and he's fun.
Yay. Yeah.
But that's the thing about Letters from Iwo Jima that I did find very compelling was it was completely from the Japanese soldier's perspective.
Right. Yeah.
And the Marines were just these sort of faceless
right.
enemies.
Blobs out there. Right.
And I was like, wow, that's me as an American growing up. That's what the Japanese were depicted for me. And it was so great to see that. And I think Saving Private Ryan kind of did it a little bit, but it did show the horror from war from any side. Mm-hmm. And you can sit there and say, oh, whatever. The politics of it, the Japanese started it. But war
small,
is awful.
And the small minds politicize any movie.
Sure. Well,
absolutely. But
absolutely.
What
you look at... They talk to empty chairs. I mean, they're insane.
Yeah.
Global warming isn't happening.
Right.
The world is flat.
Right.
So, and it's great to see a movie like that with a very... you know, a genius filmmaker. I mean, Clint Eastwood is a genius filmmaker, and you see just such an organic, flowing movie. And mm-hmm. you're like, oh no, he's telling a story. He's showing characters. He's showing a perspective we haven't seen before. You know, take the politics out of it. Watch the movie.
Right. Well, what you're saying mm-hmm. is that old expression when I was in film school, you know, it was like the first time I heard it, which is, you know, trust the art, not the artist. And in a way, that's what I, you know, I don't want to see Clint Eastwood spouting off his conservative crap. I don't want to see that because that pollutes the, you know, any enjoyment mm-hmm. of any of the movies that I do like of his, you know, mm-hmm. so.
So it was, I really liked that movie too. I mean, it was one of those movies that snuck up on you because it didn't get a huge release. Mm-hmm. It didn't get a lot of attention. And then, you know, I finally watched it on DVD. I didn't even see it in the movie theater. And it was just... I was just engrossed in this movie. It was really engaging.
And the fact that it was sort of this companion piece to Flags of Our Fathers
was
really...
It's unusual.
Of,
yeah, it's unusual.
It was nice to watch, like, if you watch those close together, it was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the war movies, like you said, like Saving Private Ryan, the one with Those battle scenes are like, you know, horrifying. Mm-hmm. And then, but then they'd always,
it
always
becomes an old war movie.
Yeah,
then it goes, becomes stock. Kind of, you know, it's like, I'm from Brooklyn. Hey, it's like, he just basically made an old 1942 war movie with like really horrific combat on either end.
Yeah. You know? So it was
we're on the World Series.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Betty Grable. Yeah.
Now you're on the trolley. Come on, let's go take that hill, boys. So let's talk to Jack now about some independent filmmaking.
Well, first we got to do this because we did tell him to see a movie.
Oh right.
Oh yeah.
So
it was homework.
He had to do homework.
I got an email to go see a movie.
And so we had to move this episode around a little bit, but I do want to hear.
But I think this movie's still out.
It's still out.
The Bourne Spring Break.
Exactly. Yeah. I actually really, literally, I could not remember the title. You know, I knew it was The Bourne. I'd seen it, and I ended up just calling it The Bourne Buddy. But I think it's Legacy.
Who's the Bourne Buddy?
Yeah. You know, Jeremy Renner is Bourne's buddy. So I saw that actually, and it was good because I got to see it for free because an editor friend of mine had a pass for the Editors Guild screening.
Right, and he didn't want to go.
So I went. Bourne
goes
saw it
to
for
ski school.
So you would think that since it was free, you know, if something is free, then you're maybe inclined just a tiny bit to like it a little more because there hasn't been any.
Because it's a gift.
It's a gift, right? So you know, even if a bad gift is still a gift, right? Mm-hmm. But this wasn't really a gift. I would have returned the gift. I would have returned it.
Can you just give me a gift card and I can buy what I want?
Totally. I would have taken the gift card. You know, listen, as a filmmaker, it's funny because it's very easy to not like anything. And you know, somebody told me, you know, an old filmmaker said once that, you know, that somebody sweat blood making the worst movie you ever saw. You know, the process of making a film is a difficult mountain to climb, and no matter
what
you do.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, you know, but anyway, the Bourne movie, you know, taking that into consideration that all movies are difficult to make, it's still not a good movie. You know, it's not a good movie. It's just not. And the problem is that the three movies that preceded it, you know, I mostly like. I mean, they're enjoyable, and I think they're well made. And Damon is great, and you buy in, and it's good. And this just sort of felt to me sort of like a slightly cheaper, less inspired version of what I had already seen.
Well, you knew when you saw the marketing campaign that this was not in good shape. When the marketing campaign was, look, there's more. There was never just one. There's more to the story. You don't know the whole story. There's more. Yeah. Like at some point, you go, stop begging me to see your stupid movie.
Right. Yeah. It's not. It's funny because Jeremy Renner, I like, and I liked him in The Hurt Locker, and he's a very earnest actor.
Hawkeye.
And
he's going to town.
Right? Yes. Very good. Mm-hmm. And he's just a thoughtful actor, and you see that he's thinking, and he's not just a model or anything like that. And he's due, you know, he's been around forever, and I like him. But it wasn't enough but the script isn't good enough, and I don't think the direction is strong enough to even, and with him in it, to keep you engaged. So for me, I found myself watching this thing, and then Rachel Wise, whatever you think of her, her part is written as essentially a whiny, rattled, you know, scientist who just can't, you know, is caught up in the thing, and she's just all rattled the whole time, and he's very calm, and she's rattled, and there's a lot of like drug taking. There's this whole component where it's like he has to take his pills. There must be 42 million shots of him taking these special pills. That if he doesn't get his next pill, he's gonna freak out, and it's all about it's all about taking pills, and that's not dramatic. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, I'm trying to think of another pill movie where pills play such a critical role, and they're not.
Drugstore,
I mean,
cowboy.
Yeah, maybe that, you know, but that, like, at least, that's part of the fabric of that movie. Yeah. This is just like spies and shit, and this pill shit goes on forever. And the only thing that happens is that I literally was like falling asleep until the last 20 minutes. There's this like balls to the walls motorcycle chase.
So it gets louder.
It just gets louder and faster. And what you expect, actually, it's actually quite staid for what these movies are. Usually, you know, when Greengrass started making them, it went into a very handheld sort of like multi-camera a shot of somebody picking their nose was covered from five cameras, and it was just like no moment was going to be boring. It was just going, or it was always going to be kinetic. And this is actually kind of very staid and sort of dull for a while. And then in the last 20 minutes, it becomes this like hysterical car chase, which is actually very good in and of itself. But
how do you take pills during a crazy car chase?
I don't want to spoil it. By that point, the pills, three quarters of the movie is about pills, and then they solve the pill issue.
They build up in your system like Zoloft.
Oh, right.
That's what it is.
So I don't know. I mean, I
he's taking Zoloft for spies.
Yeah.
Spy loft.
I happen to think
spy loft.
I am not
being a spy. Got you down.
You know,
fractured personalities getting in way of you having a normal life.
And I'm the last thing from being a snob when it comes to genre stuff. I mean, I love genre stuff, but I think that the best genre stuff is made. I don't know how to put this with real sincerity. In other words. You know, you look at something like the first Die Hard movie, and you know that John McTiernan, the director of that picture, is just all about that fucking movie. I mean, it's like they are just ringing every, you know, you have to be like, you have to mate with the damn thing. You can't just go ahead and just make it. You know, you can't do that with any movie.
Mm-hmm. Every scene was carefully crafted in that movie.
Right, it's just like you can tell somebody there is.
Even though it's an action movie, you can tell the difference.
Right, and you can feel, you know, when you have a big budget, which I've never had the benefit of a really huge budget, there's all the time in the world to get something right. Whereas in low-budget filmmaking...
The time in the world to get something wrong.
But one of the things that you can never fake is whether or not a director actually really cares about what he's doing in the moment, as opposed to just sort of trying something for effect. Like, if I do this and this and this, then this will create this effect in the audience. They will be thrilled. Whereas somebody who's actually inside the scene... And is like, however silly it might be, you know, because Die Hard in of itself is like
very funny,
very silly idea, yeah. You know, but yet you completely buy into the emotion of the thing for what it is. And I didn't get that. I think that in this movie it just feels remote, and that to me that means that the writer and the director are not necessarily all about this. They're making the thing, and it looks and smells like a movie, but it doesn't have that sort of intangible thing.
It's always that. Well, I mean, obviously,
you
know,
you think that director was the first choice?
I don't know. You know, probably. Who knows? I mean, everybody's looking for a way to get something made cheaper than they want the same result for something. Let me put it this way: like I got hired to do the sequel to Wild Things. You remember the movie Wild Things? Mm-hmm. So I did Wild Things 2 for Sony. And the sequel was made for, you know, a fraction of the original budget. But the intent was, you know,
make it as good as the first one.
Yeah, and there was a three-way in the first one, you know. So make the three-way in this one, you know, twice as
with
good.
With four people.
Yeah, exactly.
Make it a seven-way.
You know, yeah, exactly. And so there's this mandate to make, you know, to have it create the same result that the first movie did, but if you don't have the resources to make it,
or the same cast,
right? Exactly, and that's part of the resources. You know, without the resources, you're handicapped slightly. You know, so I felt, and that's what that
win
movie,
the Super
did you get
Bowl.
To do a did you get to do a Starship Troopers sequel too?
No, but the same studio made a whole bunch of
Starship Troopers. I remember those.
Yeah, now that was part of the that was definitely part of the
yes.
Yeah, so no, I mean, the same studio that made Wild Things, yeah, they made the Starship Troopers franchise. I didn't get offered that stuff, but I did end up making another monster movie, you know, sort of for my sins, I guess. you know, what you mentioned before, Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus.
Yeah, we got to talk about this movie for a second, because I watched it on streaming.
Oh, God, you actually watched it? You don't have to watch it. Just watch the trailer, and you've seen
the
movie.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. It was one of those crazy movies that was like, this never should have gotten past DVD, but somehow the trailer went viral.
And it got
a ton of attention.
That's right. What happened was is that, and again, I'm not a snob, and I love old monster movies. Raised on Ray Harryhausen stop motion animation, you know, Godzilla movies, everything, atomic mutation movies of the 50s, like them, and all the Deadly Mantis, all those pictures. So I love the genre. But what had happened was I was trying to make a movie for almost 2 years, and I had a green light to make this film that I had written and directed that I was really needed to make. Mm-hmm. And we had the green light, and I was casting, and at the last second, I got a phone call from the from the producer saying, the company fell apart, there's no movie, sorry, goodbye. And I had basically, you know, it was one of those things that happens to every filmmaker where you're like, oh, you know, okay, I guess I'll kill myself now.
Yeah. Because I have no work for the next 6 months.
And I had gambled. I mean, this movie was the movie that was going to, like, was going to resolve
launch.
The debt. And it was a WGA movie and a DGA movie. And I wrote and directed it and all. And I would limit on credit cards. And it had just all gone. So
that sounds familiar.
So, so it was one of those, you know, typical situations where, okay, it was almost like the scene in Grapes of Wrath where, like, the bulldozers are coming up the, up the front walk. And I said, okay, I'll do anything, you know. And it's funny, as a filmmaker, you're
cut to.
Yeah. You're like, okay. So I happen to know these people, these guys at the asylum.
Yes.
Because in a previous period where I felt I had reached my lowest, where I had done a couple of movies, but then I wasn't getting anything, I did a movie for them. Ultra low budget horror movie, and I knew they were always they made movies for 2 cents. They were like sub Roger Corman.
I mean, they were like sub
Roger Corman.
Well, when I was watching Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, I was just thinking, boy, I'll bet Jack wishes he just had another $20.
Just another 20.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. Like, for example, on my friend, check this out. No, it's seriously. That's I'm not even kidding. You know,
$20 was the difference.
Like, I know an actor. Like, they would get an actor for like $50 a day or something like that, maybe even less, like $35 a day. And I remember witnessing an actor being signed for another one of their movies, and they gave him the contract, you know, some PA, here, sign this for $35 a day or whatever it was. And he literally, you know, and this guy had a sense of humor, and he looked them in straight in the eye and he goes, tell him I'll do it for 40. and the PA sort of quivered. Like, I don't know if I can ask him for that much. You know, like that kind of... and so that's...
$36.50.
That's the mentality. That is the mentality of these guys. And anyway, so like my friend Barry Boswick, who's in Some Guy Who Kills People, I'll circle around the Mega Shark. He did a movie for The Asylum after he worked with us. He did a Moby Dick movie, which is basically a modern take of... It's like submarines versus Moby Dick, and he's a sub-commander, and he's Ahab. And he told me... I'm supposed to harpoon the whale, like in Moby Dick, but they didn't have a harpoon. So, like, I just told him I went home to my workshop and I made one. Like, you know, like, that's what he did. Like, Barry, like, made the prop. You know, like, usually this falls to art department. And they're like, yeah, you know, listen, if he's going to make it, yeah, go ahead. You know, like, how bad can it be? You know, we weren't going to make one anyway, you know, whatever. And he went and made his own harpoon. You know, so it's that kind of mentality. So anyway, I was happy to have any work whatsoever. And I got paid, you know, I mean, somebody who comes in to install a ceiling fan makes more than I got to do that picture. And we shot it for 12 days, in 12 days. And
regular 8-hour days?
Well, you know what? Actually, no, they were 12-hour days, but, you know, that's pretty typical. Actually,
12 was be good.
Yeah, 12
for
is good. 12 is good. And I really don't like, I've made enough movies so I can actually do a fair amount of work in 12 hours, and it's fairly mapped out. But that being said, it's so low budget. And it was, you know, it was so hampered in so many ways. And all I could keep thinking to myself is, okay, well, let me tell you this.
Hampered is a kind word, sir.
Here's the thing. In coming up with the movie, I realized that because of the budget and because it was precast with Deborah Gibson and Lorenzo Lamas, God love them.
How did that not work?
God love them.
That dream team?
No. They're perfectly, very nice, talented people, but it's
like... they got $40 a day.
Right. No, I think they got a little more. But anyway, those were the elements. There was the title, there was these two people, precast, and like come up with a movie and go make it in 12 days. And I kept putting in stuff that I thought would indicate to the viewer that I wasn't Ed Wood. Like Ed Wood, I love Ed Wood, but the beauty of Ed Wood is that he didn't know. He wasn't self-aware.
Right.
I was painfully aware of how ridiculous this thing was and what it was going to be. So I kept doing things that would indicate to a discerning viewer that, oh, okay, this guy knows that this is a pilot
show. None of them made it into the
film. Well, no, some of them did. But every time it became, anytime I was, this producer saw one of these things, whether it was a line of, and there's plenty of stuff. I have people talking about referencing Julius Caesar in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
I've got the, you know, a plane jumping out of the air, biting, you know, shark jumping out of the air, biting an airplane.
And that's what made it for the trailer.
Right. You know,
and that is a great, great scene.
But that scene remains intact. That got in there. But other things weren't, like you said, and what they would say is, hey, literally, they would look me in the eye. The producer goes, "Go, hey, this is serious stuff. Take out." They weren't kidding. They weren't kidding. They said, this is serious. Any of that, cut out any of that irony crap, because this is not a comedy. This is real. You know, this has got to be, people got to take this. I said, it's Mega Shark versus, you call it Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, and you got Deborah Gibson and Lorenzo Lamas. Like, who's going to take this seriously? You have to, you know, let everybody
in. If you don't want the Academy Award, then that's your business.
You know, get your in, let them in on the joke.
Right.
You know, let them in on the joke.
Right, because that title, had it been done the way they did, like, the Piranha movie.
Right.
The first one.
The first one.
Right.
Would have just been like, okay, I'm on board.
Right, right,
right.
You
know what I mean?
And so right now it's this weird sort of fusion of legitimate exploitation shit and a few ideas that I tried to sort of slip in that would show that it wasn't. And because the trailer, like you said, had enough of those sort of hyperbolic, insane moments, like the shark eating the plane and eating the bridge, that made it go viral. But what, the movie itself is an embarrassment. I mean, the movie, you know.
One of my favorite parts was the submarine and the Navy ship that literally looks like a set from like an office.
Oh, it is an office. No. It is an office. There's no, I'm not kidding. It is an office. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. We have submarine, all kinds of submarine scenes, as you said in the movie, where they go after the shark and the octopus. There was no submarine set, right. But there was a standing spaceship set out in the valley that had sort of a corridor, kind of octagonal, sort of tunnel-y type thing that could conceivably be repurposed as a submarine, but it was missing the essential.
Periscope.
Right, exactly. So we rented a periscope. We could afford the periscope, and we plop that down, and everybody in Navy jumpsuit, and suddenly it's a submarine. Later, there's another sub that is supposed to be the Japanese sub that's part of the dual mission to kill the monsters, and we couldn't use the same sub because, you know, it was the same set. So we happened to be in a factory where we were shooting other stuff, and we said, well, we'll just turn the camera around this way in this hallway, and we'll stick the periscope there. And again, my thinking was that anybody with half a brain is going to go, okay, you know, there's no way that the filmmaker doesn't know that this looks like, you know,
a corridor in an office.
Basically, yeah, it would look like a faculty, you know, break room,
right?
You know,
quick, the history department is attacking.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, you see the lockers on the back, you know, in the back, you know, so you know, so all that stuff. And some of the things that I put in there, I think enough people sort of got it. And all I wanted, all, you know, I would have. And the other thing is, I did it with under pseudonyms. I used the pseudonym Ace Hannah, which which comes from this film from the 50s called Vera Cruz, which is this great Western with Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster that it's probably my favorite movie. Mm-hmm. And they refer to this character Ace Hannah. Anyway, the name is so ridiculous, I figured, okay, I'll use that name as a pseudonym. And the reason I did that, even going into it, is because this company is notorious for taking the movie and editing it any way they want, which is every director's nightmare, which is the idea that they could just basically take the material and no matter how you had designed it to go together, they would add all kinds of things and shots. And if you notice in the movie, there's like endless stock footage shots of beaches and seagulls and inserts from other movies that they cut in and
they have to get it to 88 minutes.
Right. Oh yeah, no, completely. And they padded it in the worst way, in the sense that, you know, the movie came in, you know, I think the movie was to time, but they needed it for a slightly longer for some other, you know, some release requirement overseas. So they needed to find 10 minutes extra. So instead of giving you more Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus fighting each other, they just went in there and just like opened up every scene. So they basically, it's like double spacing, like in a book report, you know, where you try to get more on the page. So scenes that were tightly cut, that were already silly, became like, as my wife says, it became like watching a porno, you know, because there are things where someone will be like, look at the shark. And, you know, that's the moment when the arm comes flying up and someone says, look at the shark. That's when you cut to the shark, right? But they were like, you know, we'll just arbitrarily just space everything out. So there'll be shots of somebody going, look at the shark. Beat, 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 then you cut to the shark. So the whole thing has this sort of lopsided, awkward, badly cut sort of
pacing.
So the whole thing is just a mess.
When they said you need to take this seriously, how did you not collapse in laughter?
I couldn't even believe it. At a certain point, it's like when you're faced with somebody whose political opinions are so, you know, out to lunch You know, it's like someone saying, you know, Hitler was right. You know, right? Am I right? And
but let's hold on. If a woman is legitimately raped, her reproductive organs shut down.
Exactly.
We know this as a fact.
Exactly. So it's like when you're faced with that, it's like you can't even. Your jaw is on the ground. I can't even respond in a way. I just stared at them.
Your ears shut down. Your
yeah.
Brain.
I was like, really? You're happened. That? You're that? You're really? You're that?
You're
crazy?
Out of your mind.
Yeah, I can't talk to you. Like, how can I?
Because then you think you expect him to just start laughing after he says
right.
that. Like, oh, gotcha.
Right. Yeah, you got yeah. me. Yeah. Right. No, but they didn't get me. They kept staring. You know, with that real sincere, you know, serious look. So all I could do was I was just happy that I was able to quickly move on to a movie that was more. Within my control and more representational of what I typically do, because the last thing I want, I mean, I guess, Hollywood irony of ironies, I'd made 10 movies up to that point. This movie, and movies where I like every single thing was, like I said, sweat, blood over every single detail, you know, depth of character, you know, carefully constructed. And this silly thing that we just shat out in 12 days becomes like the thing that everybody knows me for. You know, that's the thing that everybody, you know, no one had remembered anything else. It was just like, oh, you did Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, which is like the Scarlet Letter. You know, I couldn't, so all I could do was like, please don't let me die on this note. You know, let me make another movie. And then you'll know that at least I wasn't what you thought.
That definitely happened because you made some guy who kills people.
Right. Thank God.
And this movie I really, really enjoyed, I have to say, because it hit that kind of note of like, you know what, I'm going to mix genres and I'm going to do it not only almost postmodernly, but in a way that I'm not only winking to the fans, but I'm also kind of creating something new because this doesn't normally happen. This would never happen in a mainstream film when you have basically a serial killer who finds out he has a daughter.
Right. Right.
So half the movie is his relationship with his daughter they didn't know he had, and the other half is people being killed.
Right.
And what I really loved about this movie, too, is the way it went back and forth between genres. And the acting was so good. Like, yeah. Everything from... It was really funny. Like, from the sheriff. Who played the
Barry
sheriff?
Boswick.
Barry Boswick.
Yeah, he's amazing.
The thing that I liked about it, too, is with the characters, you didn't kind of cliche it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what could have happened with these movies. And you can get away with it, too. You can
right.
cliche it up because it's low budget.
Right.
It's hard. You can make a horror comedy. You can take that easy way out.
Yeah.
And you didn't, which I really liked, is you layered the characters a little bit, too. And now
thanks.
Tell us how you got John Landis to executive produce it.
Well, yeah.
How did this movie come about?
Well, it started, I mean, the movie started like all good movies with a really great script.
And did you hand everybody Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus? Here's my next movie.
Well, what happened was I got a call from my manager who heard that they were looking for a director for this movie, and I got sent the script, Ryan Levin's script, which was great. You know, and again, it was one of those things where, you know, everybody thinks they can write, and you read a lot of scripts, and 99.9% of them are not good because they're not written by people who are any good or have a point of view or whatever. Anyway, so Ryan's script was like exactly, it was like the tonic that I needed after the toxin of Mega Shark versus Giant. It was just the characters were fully dimensional. The wit, the comedy was not only clever, but it was character based. It was not gags. It came out of character. It was genuinely offbeat. And it was just the thing that I was just dying to make. And like you said, it had this amazing combination of horror and comedy and dramatic components, which never mesh, rarely, except for something like An American Werewolf in London. Like, I was thinking about
a John Landis movie?
Well,
that's weird.
Here's the story, is that I didn't know Landis was involved at all.
Mm-hmm.
I had known nothing. And when I was talking to
real quick, it's hard to mesh those three things.
It sure is.
Right.
It really is. And if you are even just a half inch off, it is so.
It's over.
You've ruined the whole thing.
It's over. I think that you're right. I think most if there is a horror comedy subgenre, usually, like you said, it's very broad kind of stuff. It's all kind of toilet humor.
Or Shaun of the Dead or something like that.
Well, actually,
that.
But, you know, Shaun of the Dead, I think, is actually, you know, or I think Shaun of the Dead is actually, you know, of a very high caliber, where something like, you know, Scary Movie or...
Oh, that
you know, that kind of
the
stuff.
Comedy first.
Yeah, you know,
okay.
where it's just sort of banana peel, sort of like booby caca humor,
yeah,
you know what
sure.
I mean? But, you know, what happened was is that I went in and I referenced An American Werewolf in London, and they the producers, these co-producers and the writers sort of looked at each other funny. Like, well, that's funny that he mentioned that. I didn't understand what that meant at the time. When I finally ended up getting the job, it was revealed to me that Landis had originally been slated to direct it.
Oh, wow.
That's what would happen. Landis was going to direct it. And then he got the chance to do a big budget picture in England, funny enough, with Simon Pegg, called Burke and Hare, which is a project that he had wanted to make for many years. So he said, okay, well, I was going to do this, but I really want to do this, so
Hire the new guy.
I'm going to go. So hire somebody to replace me. And what happened was, when he left, the budget just went, ooh, this budget.
He brought the budget with him.
Yeah, the budget went to nothing. So they needed somebody who could do the movie in 16 days, which was actually, you know, a luxury compared to the 12 days I had on Megashark. And Landis was really at that point, you know, like, look, I'll remain as executive producer. I'll oversee and give any advice. And, you know, and he had a hand in the latter development of the script. So he was like, I'll be in on this, but I'm going to go make my movie and hire somebody that you, you know, trust. And so I got hired. He approved me. We made the movie, and he was the perfect executive producer in the sense that he didn't interfere at all with the production. When it was over, we showed him a cut, and he was, you know, very happy with the movie and gave us a few notes. But basically, it was the best possible experience because he honored what we were doing, and he thought it worked, and that was like, you know. And for me, it was like I say in the behind the scenes stuff in the movie, he was like a teacher or a parent I wanted to please because I had so admired his movies.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted him to say, good job, kid. You know, unfortunately, he did. So that was all. I was like, oh, gee, John Landis likes my movie. All right, great. You know, I felt vindicated in a way. So,
well, there's a thing, too. And just for any listeners out there who haven't seen An American Werewolf in London, check that out. It came out in the 80s, and it was really sort of...
It's groundbreaking.
It is. It's very inventive for the time, because I don't think we had a movie that had combined the drama and the humor and the horror together so effectively in that film.
No, it was.
Well, John Landis is a master at that.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, people had, you know, you'd see kind of hints at it in his other stuff, but they were basically flat out comedies. I mean, Animal House, Blues Brothers, Trading Places. And then you see American Werewolf in London, where it not only has this groundbreaking effect stuff, this transformation stuff, werewolf transformation stuff, but like you said, it has this real sort of like dramatic component. And at the end, it's a legitimate tragedy.
Yeah.
But it's fall down funny. I mean, the shit.
It's hilarious when he wakes
Griffin
up Dunn,
with stuff with Griffin Dunn and their whole back and forth. It's hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's hilarious.
Coming back from the dead.
He's coming back from the dead, and it's just there's definitely just like straight on, you know, just hilarious shit in there.
When he wakes up in the wolf cage at the zoo, naked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just But again, that scene encompasses the whole film. It's funny, the visual, but then he's also like...
He's reacting like a real person.
I'm naked with a goddamn wolf.
It's not commenting, and that's what I wanted to do with Some Guy Who Kills People is, like you said, I could have made the small town sheriff, the Karen Black plays Kevin Gorgon, the, you know, quote-unquote serial killer's, you know, sort of, you know, mean mother. I could have taken those sort of archetypes and made them the standard, you know, two-dimensional characters. But the script was written so richly, and we managed for the first time. I never get the cast, the perfect cast. This was the first time where I got Kevin Corrigan, who I've known for many years, to play the lead.
Kevin Corrigan is great.
He's great. Yeah. Lucy Davis, who was in Shaun of the Dead in the original Ricky Gervais office to play his love interest. You know, Barry Boswick as the sheriff, Karen Black, and on and on and on. All of them were just great, great actors.
And it has some great quiet moments, too. That's the one thing that I liked about the movie, too, where they're just, you know, when there's not all this mayhem going on, just the kind of the relationship moments of a guy who didn't know he had a daughter. And add that to the fact that he'd been in a mental institution for a long time. I mean, those scenes are, like, really interesting.
And Kevin Corrigan is one of those guys that... Most people probably don't know his name, but when they see his face, they go,
I know that guy.
Yeah. Right. They go, I know that guy's in Pineapple Express. That guy's in Superbad. I know who that is.
And I love when you find a guy like that and he gets a starring role and really gets to flex because it's always in a supporting role in the other stuff.
And totally. A thousand short films.
Yeah,
too.
A thousand short films.
If you've gone to
episodes of CSI or whatever.
Yeah.
Like,
exactly. Yeah.
And then when a guy like that gets to really flex, you go, oh, man.
Right.
It's so impressive.
Yeah, I always thought he was wonderful. And this part, you know, it's like Kevin Corrigan has this great sort of, you know, he can definitely do the darker side of a character, and he's
just with a look.
Yeah, you know, and that's why you see him in The Departed. You know, he plays Leonardo DiCaprio's crazy drug addicted cousin. You know, you see him in all kinds of pictures, but I always knew him as a very warm character, and that's a big part of the movie, is that he's not just like he's not Norman Bates with a daughter. He's like a guy. I never really looked at him as a serial killer so much as somebody. It's almost like he's almost like a vengeance killer. He's out for revenge is really what it is. And so those scenes, those quiet scenes that you talk about, the scenes with his daughter, those are really the scenes that I love directing. It's really the intimate stuff. Funny, because you know, people look at Megashark versus Giant Octopus and like they would probably think I'm the last person who would be interested in like little quiet moments. You know, people at a dinner table.
There were no quiet moments in that movie.
No, I mean, it's all, you know, but those are the things I love doing, and so this script afforded that. But yeah, mm-hmm. I was really happy to make that picture.
Well, let's go in. I mean, we've sort of touched on some of it, but let's go in sort of, since you have some experience with the indie film, I mean,
yeah,
what that difference is compared to a big budget film.
Right. Well, I mean,
obviously there's the obvious of time and money.
Right.
You know, there's no big budget film that has 16 days. It's got, you know, 50
that's a
or,
scene.
Or 60.
Right. Yeah. No, for sure. That's the biggest.
But the technology has changed too. I mean, we could talk about that as well.
That's true. Well, you know, look, I don't think that. I think time is the real issue. I mean, I have friends who've made bigger pictures for studios, and I'll get a phone call, you know, from the set of this big studio picture, and they're like, "Yeah, man, I've got to shoot two pages on a bench today, and I don't know if I'm going to make it. You know, it's two people on a bench, mm-hmm. and I got two pages, and I'm just like, fuck you, man. It's like I got to shoot, I got to shoot sharks and airboats and things blowing up, and that's in the morning, and then after lunch,
I got to make an office look like a submarine.
Yeah, you know, it's like that stuff. I mean,
and take it seriously.
Right, right. So the truth is that. Yes, with more money and a studio behind you, you definitely get more time to do your thing. The problem is that you also have 80 million studio executives on your ass, not letting you be as creative as you might be able to be on an independent film, because everybody's afraid of the money, of losing the money. And you've got on a studio level, you've got a million executives that are all somewhat accountable in the sense that they're going to be blamed. They're going to be blamed somehow. And so it's a combination of fear, which is a huge part of it, that someone's going to make a mistake and I'm going to be accountable for it and I'm going to get fired and lose my cushy job. It's that, and it's also...
Even though I deserve to.
Right, exactly. and so that's not the right environment to do work, to do any kind of creative work.
Really getting notes from people motivated by fear? That's not
like
the best creative environment?
Yeah, right. No, it's it still happens on the low budget, but it just happens at a fraction of what happens on a studio level.
Well, I mean, like... How do you, you know, because we have a lot of young filmmakers that listen to the show. So what sort of mindset do you get in when you're going into like some guy who kills people?
Right.
You had 16 days. You had, you know, a very, can you say what the budget was or no?
Well, none. I mean,
sure, right. You had a small budget.
It's under $1 million budget.
Okay.
You know, well under.
Right. Which is not a lot for a feature film.
Right.
So like what, how are you even going into this knowing that you're not going to have, you have to shoot 10 pages or 15
right.
pages a day.
Right. On average, you end up shooting, on a low budget movie, you end up shooting seven and a half pages a day. Mm-hmm. And what I ended up doing is my philosophy for how to approach this is to just back into it from an editorial perspective. In other words, and I've said this before to some of my students, you know, Elia Kazan, you know, the great director of On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire, when they asked him at the end of his career or the end of his life, really, what would you have done differently since he was such a notable...
Not rat out comics.
Exactly. That should have been the first thing. I would not have ratted out my friends to the House of Un-American Activities Commission. But the second thing I would have done differently is he said I would have started in the editing room. And that is the best advice I think you can give any young filmmaker, because ultimately everything you do, the writing of the script, the casting, the production part of it, that's all in service of how it's ultimately going to be put together. And what they usually teach you incorrectly is something that I really hate, which is called coverage, which is just it's just basically shooting the same scene from a lot of different camera positions and covering it. You know, if it's three of us sitting here talking, we get a master shot of the three of us, we get close-ups of each of us, we get over the shoulders. You basically get inserts of my hands. You get
so
a
you
whole
get, bunch. Give the editors a bunch of choices,
right? Which I don't think is the way to do it. Particularly, not even if you had all the time in the world, I don't think it's the way to do it, because it's the way the film goes together a film goes together a certain way, and a really strong director understands how that movie goes together. Hitchcock was the greatest example of somebody who had pre-visualized the movie shot by shot, storyboarded to the point where when he made the movie, he said he was bored because he already knew what it was going to be.
Right.
It wasn't a discovery process. It was like it was engineered. Now, that's a cold word, but I think just from a point of how you shoot something, you should think about it that what is this moment in the script, what shot does it live in? If you see it in your mind's eye that it's two people sitting side by side in a two-shot for that moment where they look into each other's eyes and kiss, then maybe that's the shot you should commit to on the day and shoot it that way rather than shoot the two-shot, the overs, the close-ups, just so that just in case maybe I want – it's and that only comes from experience. I mean, as a young filmmaker, I probably shot more than – I know I shot more than I ended up using. But there's also something incredibly heartbreaking. It's a really good lesson. When you get into the cutting room and you realize that 50% of what you shot isn't in the movie. And look at all the amount – and this is where we come back to the time thing. Look at the amount of time that I spent getting those shots, how it took 20 minutes to just move the camera.
Sure.
How many takes did I do with that actor? And the performance is so good in this angle, and yet – guess what? The other angle is better for the moment. So if I can learn that lesson now, then when I shoot my next movie, I will dedicate a particular angle to a particular moment and shoot that and maybe do enough takes, but then move on. You know, almost like blah, you know. So
right,
it's like
right.
You're saying, it's like it's almost like it's a relay race with a baton. Like this shot goes to this shot, goes to this shot, and you pre-cut it in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that way you can finesse the performances and you can finesse the camera moves because you're not obliged to shoot it every which way. And that, I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, but it's the only way I see you can do good work within very tight parameters. Because if you tried the coverage approach, which is I got to shoot this a million different ways, then it's just rushed because you don't have the time. I'll get a take of this, I'll get a take of that. And then you just get a lot of like mediocre performances and mediocre camera work.
Why not just shoot a solid two shot and
that works?
Yeah, that's
right.
The thing.
Then they get afraid if you lose footage. Well, now we lost the whole scene.
No, that's well, that's the thing too. And I remember a film professor said this to all of us. He said everyone here should take some acting classes and learn at least what it's like to be on the other side of it. And I remember.
That's very true.
Studying at when I first moved out here at Playhouse West in the Valley, and which is a really it's a Meisner school. It's very mm-hmm. intense. That's where I read that Kazan book and a bunch of others. I remember that, and there were several directors in the class who were just like, I want to learn how to do this. And I remember then, you know, you would go on the set and work on something, and they would be obsessed with the coverage. And it's like, you guys are so obsessed with the coverage, you're losing the emotion of this scene.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm a film actor, so I know I got to cut it up. It, you know, I
right.
got to cut the scene up. But if you cut it up too much, why do that when you could shoot
mm-hmm.
the whole thing together,
right.
which will capture the emotion better? You know,
right.
I don't care how good of an actor you are, if you can. That's always going to be preferable. Me and you acting one-on-one.
Sometimes let the camera run. Just capture
right,
the scene.
Yeah. I mean, look at something like mm-hmm. Drive. I mean, Drive is a really good example of this sort of philosophy in play. If you look at Drive, whatever you think of the movie, that's a movie where that director directed the shit out of it, but not in a Michael Bay hose it down with a million different camera angles. That is like, this moment is going to play in this shot entirely. One shot, and then its scene is
mm-hmm.
over. Next, this scene is going to play in this shot, or maybe these two shots over. You know, and they're strong shots. And if you find John Huston was the master at that. John Huston never had all great film directors will say Huston was the guy who knew exactly where to put the camera for the moment. And when you look at Huston's films, whether it's you know The Maltese Falcon or The Man Who Would Be King or whatever,
you can't imagine any other shot.
You know,
in
that's
each scene.
A shot.
Yeah.
You know, and it's never overcovered. It's never like you're seeing this moment from 32 different angles.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing it from this one.
And black and white film was expensive,
right?
Well, that's a lot of those old directors did. They because part of it was they probably didn't. You know, they didn't have all this technology, and they couldn't have six cameras rolling at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be judicious with it, but they also all came from theater.
Right.
They all came from theater where they wanted to capture the emotion of that moment in this scene, which, you know, theater is a playwright's medium.
Mm-hmm.
So they were taking the playwright's medium and then putting it visually. And that's the effect. And, like, I remember an interview with Glenn Close talking about working with Robert Redford in The Natural.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, okay, I'll play the coverage game, but he would always make sure that they would shoot the close-ups last.
Right.
and he'd say, "I'm just saving up for the close up."
Right.
You know, he would just sort of, okay, because he knew that
he knew where it was going to play. But see, think about that logic. In other words, if you know a scene is going to play in close ups, because it's
then shoot it.
Shoot the close ups.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
You know, like, why? I can't tell you how many times I've told students, you know, like that where they're shooting five takes or seven takes of a master. Of two people at a restaurant, and it's a shot of the whole restaurant, and two people, they're like two raisins back there, and they're shooting the master. And I'm like, why are you using up the actor? Let me first I say, like, how many times do you think you're going to cut to this in your edit? Like,
once at the beginning,
maybe once in the middle when the waiter comes over so right. You can see him, and once at the end if you're going to do that at all. So why are you using up your actors? Why, you know, like, I forget who said it. Somebody told me a great story. I think it might have been someone was recounting. I think it was Slim Pickens. Someone like Slim Pickens or Chill Wills, an old cowboy actor. He said, "You know how we used to do the masters in the old days and the old, you know, two-reeler westerns?" He's like, I'd ride into town on a horse in a wide shot. I'd say my first line, I'd take a beat, and I'd say my last line and ride out. And that was the idea. In other words, it's like, because they knew that you were going to see him ride into town, say, "Hey," and then there'd be a whole scene, and then you cut back and you'd go, "Okay, see you later," and he'd ride out. And they would just... They would know, because those were low-budget movies. They say, fuck it, we're not going to run the whole scene because we'll never use it. So just say your first line, take a pause, keep the camera rolling, say your last line, ride out, boom. You know, like, that's like sort of that.
It's so funny. We've talked about it a lot on the show, and it's great to hear your perspective as a filmmaker, because Hollywood has gotten a little drunk on the technology. And the technology is fine, and we talked about it a couple episodes ago with when we did the show with Frank Woodward and Douglas Tate. You know, the technology is great, but if you're obsessed with it, if you just Michael Bay and you just...
Douglas Tate as a creature actor, or a suit actor, we should
suit
say.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
And we're talking about practical versus CG.
Right, right.
And
oh, but let me interrupt.
Which I'm a big fan of, by the way.
Let me interrupt, by the way. I remember I wanted to mention this. Men in Suits, the Kickstarter campaign, within 24 hours of this episode going, it was funded.
Yeah.
Jeez, and, wow. So it's the bump.
Yeah,
because
you guys were amazing.
Shit,
and like I said,
I wish I had a project.
Bring it, kiddo.
Because we will be carrying that film here on the site. And then 48 hours after that, then it was $1,000 over.
Jeez.
So I'm thinking, all right, our fans are now just showing off.
We've helped fund two graphic novels,
jeez,
the podcast festival, and now the Men in Suits movie.
Oh, well, shit. I got to come back with my...
I got to fucking put some shit on there.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Bump yourself.
I might help with my Australia tour
right,
to fund
yeah.
it. So
yeah,
we
God.
Might do it.
But so what... What do you have coming up, Jack?
I
will you be using your real name?
I will. Well, we'll see.
Who's Ace Hannah? When can we see more of his work?
Who knows? I mean, it's like, again, like, you know, the editing part of a movie is I think the most essential aspect of directing, and unfortunately, it's the one part of the equation that usually no directors have anymore. I mean, Michael Cimino is the one who, you know, is kind of credited for ending the whole auteur power thing, where directors had final cut. And there are very few directors that have that anymore, if any. So that means that any producer, any studio exec can kind of whiz on your movie and change it. And like I said, I used that pseudonym because I knew that movie was going to be so messed with. There was no point. Some Guy Who Kills People was the exact opposite, where there wasn't one thing in that movie that I didn't want to be that way. This last thing, I'm finishing up a movie for Sci-Fi Channel, so we're back paying the rent.
Mega Octopus versus Giant Shark.
No, not quite. But check this title. It's called Blowing Vegas Off the Map is the name of the movie. I got Barry Boswick back because I just enjoy working with him so much. And he's playing kind of a semi-washed up Vegas lounge singer who assists these kids in saving Las Vegas they don't save Las Vegas. Las Vegas basically gets knocked down by a supernatural sandstorm.
Yes.
That's the movie. And so it's a huge disaster-y
picture. It doesn't happen when I'm at Harrah's September 25th through the 30th.
I think we're very democratic. I think that was part of the thing that if we blew up one, I think legally, if we blew up one casino in the movie, you have to blow them up all of them. Otherwise, sure, you're making a statement like, well, we don't really like Harrah's that much, so we're only going to, you have to blow up everything. So everything gets blown up in that movie. So I'm finishing that up. But really, Ryan Levin and myself, who wrote Some Guy Who Kills People, that's really what I'm looking forward to doing, is just doing another project with him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's our show, man. That was awesome. That was
really
a phenomenal
cool. Definitely
film
a
discussion.
Good perspective.
That was really great. It's always great having filmmakers in here because it's very different. So Well, that's our show. So where can people get Some Guy Who Kills People?
It's available now on DVD, on iTunes, Amazon Instant. You can also, and Redbox as well. If you go to someguywhokillspeople.com, it'll lead you everywhere you need to go.
Awesome. Jack Perez, Some Guy Who Kills People, and Mega Shark versus Octopus. And when you watch it, I want you to watch it seriously. Yeah. I don't want you to fuck around when you watch that movie. So thank you so much for being
Deborah Gibson, now that she's older.
Deborah Gibson, Lorenzo Lamas, who's been married half a dozen times, has a couple alimony issues, I'm sure. Yes. That's our show. I will be, as I said, I'll be in Las Vegas at the Improv at Harrah's September 25th through the 30th, provided it hasn't been blown up by Ace Hanna.
Supernatural sandstorm.
By Ace Hanna and his bag of craziness coming across the desert. So, check that out. And, of course, as we said, Los Angeles Podcast Festival, October 12th through 14th, lapodfest.com.
Tickets still available, and there may even be a few hotel rooms left, but they're going very quickly.
We don't have that many of them. So check that out. Come out for Santa Monica, four blocks from the beach. Walk to the pier, the Third Street Promenade. You can take the big blue bus directly from LAX, bus number 3. I've done this before. It'll stop right in front of the Sheraton Delphine. It costs you $1. How about that? Boom. All right, guys. That's our show. Thank you once again to Jack Perez. My name is Graham Elwood.
I'm Chris Mancini. And as always, remember,
Han shot first. Unless it's a mega shark.
Or giant octopus. <That's awesome. laughs>